The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Join us this week is a man of infinite patience and a very wonderful reporter for the New York Times, Jesse McKinley, the Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thank you, Alan.
The green light law controversy in New York. You have explained this to me in the past. I wonder if you would be good enough to go through it one more time. What's the difference between the state position on this and the federal?
Okay, well, you first of all have to go back to last year when the state legislature and Governor Cuomo signed a law called the Green Light Law, which basically allowed the state to issue driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants. Now, part of this law was that it forbade state authorities from sharing driver's license information, DMV information, with federal authorities. This was controversial at the time it passed and at the time the governor signed it, but it nonetheless took effect in December when counties across the state started to issue driver's licenses. Now, flash forward to the State of the Union address the other night. President Trump made a great deal of hay on attacking New York State for this law, arguing that it had led to basically sanctuary status in some cities, and that had led to the death of a 92-year-old woman. That was doubled down on by federal authorities on Wednesday night when the Department of Homeland Security announced that they would no longer cooperate with New York State in terms of this global entry program, which are these kind of expedited ways of getting through airline security, arguing that because the state will not share information with federal authorities on immigration status, they couldn't assure that people going through this program were safe flyers. Now, the Cuomo administration itself responded almost immediately to this, calling it political retaliation. And of course, there are kind of a long history of antagonism between Mr. Cuomo and Mr. Trump. But in the meantime, for travelers kind of gearing up for winter breaks and what have you, this program is suspended for people that want to re-enroll or people that want to enroll. And it seems to not have an easy solution. One would suspect that this is going to end up in the courts and certainly continue to percolate. So
just to be clear, Jesse McKinley, people who have driver's licenses who are undocumented will continue to have them, right? I mean, that part of it stays set.
Yes, that state law was passed in June, signed in June, and took effect in December. And in most counties around the state, county clerks began to accept applications for driver's licenses regardless of immigration status. This was controversial in some parts of the state, including Rensselaer County, right across from Albany, and had been challenged in other parts of the state. But by and large, the program took effect and resulted in kind of around-the-block lines in places like New York City, which have large populations of people who may not have proper documentation to be in the country. So from a proponent standpoint, the law has been a roaring success, and it is worth noting, this is not necessarily a controversial idea. Other states do this sort of thing and have not been censured by the federal government, as near as I know, for allowing people without proper documentation to get driver's licenses. But this feels very much like a showdown between Mr. Trump and Mr. Cuomo, who don't seem to like each other very much at all.
Interesting. Very interesting. So let's talk about bail reform, if we can go there. I think the Republicans believe they have a huge issue here and that they could make incredible gains, including the possibility of making some gains in the New York Senate, where you have written the GOP senators have been flooding the exits.
That is absolutely true on both accounts. I think the bail reform law, which also passed during last year's session, which was a monumental session, a lot of big progressive pieces of legislation got through. In this case, the bail reform law, which also took effect recently on January 1st, has been controversial, particularly in moderate suburban districts on Long Island and in some portions of upstate, kind of mirroring the green light law. And Republicans seem very confident that they are going to be able to make hay on this in 2020. Democrats privately expressed some trepidation about the law and about its potential political impact. There have been Democratic lawmakers in both the state assembly and the state Senate who have said, look, we need to revisit this. But at least in Albany right now, both leaders of the Senate and of the assembly are saying, no, we have to wait. We have to be very cautious about this. And, you know, we don't generally revise laws a month after they take effect. But as this is going on, there has been a drumbeat of bad press for the law. You know, people that have let out on bail who have then subsequently been arrested for new alleged crimes. And this has become almost a daily occurrence.
The so-called Willie Horton effect.
Yeah, to an extent. But Republicans have really been hammering Democrats on this. And Democrats have been fighting back and saying, look, this cherry picking, this is fear mongering, this is kind of playing to the worst elements of human nature, to the you know, scaring people and getting them upset. But by the same token, that has proven to be a pretty effective way of getting people to the polls and has certainly won elections in the past. So I would not be surprised if Republicans run on this and run hard on it in the fall.
So Speaker Hasty, Carl Hasty, has a particular problem here. I mean, he's the one who really has stood at the door and said no to Governor Cuomo and others who are saying we have to fool with this thing, saying no, we have to live with it for a while. In the meantime, the Republicans are making hay.
Yeah, I mean, Carl Hasty is in somewhat of a tough position, I would think, politically, because obviously there are people that are clamoring for change in this. He has been pretty steadfast in saying, look, it's too soon. You know, we're only 35, 36, 37 days in. I had an interview with him earlier this week where I said, well, you know, at what point is enough time to evaluate the efficacy of a law? You know, are we talking 90 days? Are we talking 180 days? And he said, you know, I don't want to put a timetable on it. You know, we have to let the system work. So obviously, there's a legal argument to be made saying, look, laws take effect and you have to wait to see the data and see what happens. But the political argument here is going to get more and more clamorous, I think. I think that, you know, if there is a continuation of the bad press, then I think that some members are going to get very skittish about being on the side of making no changes to the bail law. So we shall see.
Look, we all know that bail reform was needed. The question is, what would the fix look like? What I've been reading from you and everybody else is that it's the judges who need a little bit more authority to keep bad actors in jail.
Yeah, I mean, the question here has always been one of judicial discretion. You know, in the state of New Jersey, they took a very methodical approach to this. They passed a law in 2014 and had a number of public hearings. It didn't take effect, I don't think, until 2017. And one of the arguments being made by the people that opposed the bail reform is, look, the New York State didn't take enough time. They rushed this. They threw this at us. You know, we only had 9 months to adapt. And bail reformers say, look, these are things that have been instituted in other states. They have been shown to reduce crime rather than increase crime, that the cases of that are being highlighted are simply being cherry picked out of, you know, a number of cases that have been quite successful, and that people that have been accused of crimes have been able to go home and spend time with their families while they're awaiting trial, which they argue helps maintain community and job and home security, which is all important to kind of keeping people's lives together, even if they are accused of crimes. So, there's potent and emotional arguments on both sides of this issue. And you know, I think that there will probably be changes made. I think that there's enough political pressure kind of building. But the idea somehow that the Republicans are going to repeal this entire law and get it all changed, I think that is that's not going to happen. But I would not be surprised if there were tweaks made this legislative session.
So does Carl Hasey, the speaker, who represents a diverse district which has suffered under this bail stuff, does he face revolution in his speakership?
I don't think revolution. I think his position is pretty secure. I think Carl's very popular in that conference. And in a weird way, you could argue, you know, if he has had a hallmark of his, what is it, 4 years, 5 years now as speaker, it's been that he's been pretty democratically minded. He usually, when you ask him about, you know, his opinions on things, he says, well, it's not really my opinion, it's the opinion of the conference. So he has been pretty steadfast in kind of hearing out other people's opinion inside of, you know, the 100 members, the 100 Democrats in the assembly. But on this issue, he seems more resolute and it almost seems more personal to him to kind of hold the line on this. As you point out, you know, he's from the Bronx. The Bronx has been a place where there have been a lot of accusations of mass incarceration, of police brutality, of police malfeasance. And I think that bail reform is a big issue in his district, in his borough, that he feels very passionately, it was time to make changes in these laws. And he does not seem to be backing down from that.
I would only point out, for whatever it's worth, Jesse, that even Shelley Silver and everybody else who we knew were the strongmen always said, it's up to my conference.
Fair enough.
Okay. So let's take the subtext here just for a minute, and that is, why are all of these Republicans heading for the doors in the Senate?
Well, I think it's interesting. I think there had been a sense, particularly when the Republicans lost the majority in 2018, that they were going to be in the wilderness for a very long time. The Democrats in the state Senate now hold a 40-23 margin. And although that's really only 8 seats when you do the math, that's still a pretty big margin. And in the districts that they seemingly lost in 2018, it didn't seem like those districts were going to flip back red anytime soon. They seemed to be getting more blue rather than more red. But that being said, this bail issue has given Republicans hope because they feel like they can kind of cleave Democratic voters away from the party by basically using bail reform as an example of, you know, progressives gone crazy. By the same token, you know, the green light law, I think, will probably come up. It may even touch on things about like the marijuana legalization push, which is a popular issue if you look at national polls. But once again, it is technically the feds look at marijuana as an illegal drug. Some people still hold the opinion that it's a gateway drug. You know, that's not my opinion, but my opinion doesn't matter. But still, these are potent political arguments, if you'll excuse the pun. So, getting marijuana through may be a difficult task. And the governor has suggested as much in interviews with you and other people that, you know, for some moderate suburban lawmakers, this may be difficult to do at a time in which they're already getting hammered on bail and on the green light law. So we'll see once again.
I would point out that there's a new news story that has emerged about the AAA saying too many people are driving under the influence and getting into accidents. I don't know if that's true, but I do know that that's the kind of thing that one faces when one passes this. In my home state of Massachusetts, we have it. It doesn't seem to have caused any real problems, for whatever it's worth.
I'll take your word for it, Alan.
Yes, I've gone around and counted them myself. So New York now faces a $6.1 billion, that's with a B, dollar budget deficit in 2020. Speaker Hasty likes a plan to tax the rich. We hear from Andrea Stewart Cousins in the other house, the leader of the Senate, that there shouldn't be tax raises of any kind. What do you make of that?
The assembly, which Casey leads, has been high on the idea of raising taxes on the super wealthy for a while. They've passed these sorts of measures in previous sessions. They haven't gotten anywhere either because of the old Republican Senate or because of, that they're not being political need or political power for new taxes. Governor Cuomo has shot that down, idea down on numerous occasions, including most recently this week. So I think it's a little bit of a difficult sell. Now, that being said, a $6 billion budget gap can change some minds pretty quickly, and there are all sorts of ideas now being floated to try to fill that hole, including, of course, the governor's Medicaid redesign team, which was unveiled this week and is supposed to find $2.5 billion, once again with a B, to help kind of backfill that budget gap. That should be an interesting thing to watch. It feels almost extra governmental in that these experts from various fields are going to come together and try to figure out a way to cut monies from a very robust Medicaid program. And the governor has made it clear that he's going to ask the counties to do more. The counties are not particularly thrilled about this because they are already on the hook for about 10% of a $75 billion Medicaid bill every year. And they feel that this is unfair, that they are once again being asked to either, revisit programs or crack down on administrative problems or administrative staffing or crack down on eligibility when a lot of these things are out of their hands. So, that will be another coming bite. And just while we're talking about the budget gap, there may be pressure not only for things like marijuana legalization, which could bring some money into the kitty, but also things like casinos and other revenue enhancers, as they
More
put it.
sports betting.
More sports betting. The Super Bowl's over, but the betting's just begun. It could make those sorts of revisions more palatable as well. And yes, the idea of taxing the wealthy will be on the table. And politically speaking, will be an interesting look, right? Because progressives very much want this sort of thing. They feel it's only fair that the rich pay more because they have more. And more moderate centrists like Governor Cuomo feel, oh no, if you tax the rich, they're going to run out of the state of New York,
Sure.
and we're going to decimate the tax base that way. So that will be a push and pull that will go on, I think, right till the end of the budget season, at March 31st.
And of course, if I know Andrew Cuomo the way I think I do, if you're a county leader, you really don't want to get in touch with him, because you got to mute your objections because you don't want him to come back at you.
Yeah, I think that, I don't think anyone would question the statement that Mr. Cuomo is an outsized presence in New York State government. I mean, he knows everybody. He's been in the job for 9+ years and has been in New York State politics for 30 years before that. So, he knows these people's cell phone numbers, and he knows not only how to cajole them, but also probably cudgel them, when he needs to. So, I don't know that anyone necessarily on a county level, which depends on the state, obviously, for a lot of resources, wants to cross him. But by the same token, the counties do have a logical and potent argument that, New York is one of the few states that even asked counties to pony up for Medicaid, and for them to now have to pony up more or to, cut staff or to limit eligibility or things like that. A lot of that is not their, not, you know, the state and the feds set those eligibility standards, and they feel they're being made the scapegoat for something that A, they didn't create, and B, they can't really control.
Elise Stefanik, let's talk about her for a minute. She's now the heroine of the Republican group and a fierce defender, which she hasn't always been, of the president, and money is flying into her coffers.
Yep, I think the most recent haul for Ms. Stefanik was over $3 million. She outraised, I think, most, if not all, congressional candidates, including Adam Schiff, the California Democrat.
And AOC. And
AOC, New York's own. You know, this is going to be the congressional race in New York's 21st, which is the big chunk of the beautiful Adirondacks, is going to be a heck of a race. You know, Elise Stefanik, as you mentioned, has become kind of a Republican standout, a very strident defender of President Trump, despite, you know, some talk earlier in her career that she was kind of more of a moderate and, you know, kind of a peacemaker and, you know, had a kind of more centrist worldview. She has turned into, you know, a very fierce Trumper in this third term. And Tedra Cobb, who's running against her in the 21st, has also been raising money. I think she is, this will be her second attempt to try to get rid of Ms. Stefanik out of the 21st. And progressive groups and progressive donors really like her chances and really want to make a statement by trying to beat Elise Stefanik in the 21st.
Any chance?
By the same, you know, that is a pretty red district. But Democrats, I think we're feeling, you know, hopeful about places like that. You know, it's difficult to make any political predictions, and my political predictions are almost always wrong. So, you know, in this day and age, political winds can change hour to hour, minute to minute. I think a month ago when the president was being impeached and there was kind of a, you know, endless drumbeat of bad news about Republicans, I think you would have been not without good reason to think that maybe Tedra Cobb could beat Elise Stefanik. I think the Republicans have had a good couple of weeks with the president being impeached, or rather acquitted from impeachment, from the State of the Union address, from the kind of economy, which seems to be doing okay. So, you know, I think Republicans now are feeling quite bullish that they'll not only hold those seats, but maybe pick off a seat here or there. The other races that are interesting, obviously, are the 19th Congressional in the Hudson Valley, the Utica District, which I think is the 22nd, which Republicans want to get back. And then, of course, there's the 27th, where Chris Collins, who's headed off to jail, has vacated his seat, and Democrats are hoping to pick up that seat as well, which is between Rochester and Buffalo. I think that's going to be heavy sledding, but that will be one of the first elections coming up in April, and that may be a bellwether of whether or not Democrats can win Republican seats.
So a lot of people are saying Andrew Cuomo is sounding more and more like a national presidential candidate. He's just becoming the head of the governors, this Democratic Governors Association. Do you think he's running for president, assuming that there is a loss, that Trump wins election? Then Cuomo would be in a position to run something that we saw with his father, too, as I remember it.
What a strange question. And I feel like I've never heard this question from you before, but leaving that aside, I will say that I'm pretty 99.9% sure he's not running for president this year. That we know. But 4 years from now is an epoch in you know, political time. There's no way of knowing what the nation will look like. There's no way of knowing who the president will be. There's no way of knowing, you know, if Andrew Cuomo wants to remain in the public eye. Maybe he'll want to retire and go fishing. But that being said, all of those caveats, you know, he has certainly made a case for being a pragmatic progressive, which is his term, and I think his father's as well, for a guy that gets things done, that has big infrastructure projects that should be coming to fruition by then, who will have, you know, a credible case to have made some major liberal advancements in the state of New York. So certainly he would have the resume to run for a higher office. The question, of course, as it was with his father, is whether he has the gumption and the drive. You know, it takes a major commitment to run for president. You know, it's years of your life. It's tons of fundraising. It's lots of travel. It's lots of time of being away from your loved ones. It's intense scrutiny. And for almost everybody, you lose. You know, there's only one guy or one lady who ends up being the president.
So we only have 3 minutes left. So, of course, I want to mention the other New Yorker who is being featured prominently in a lot of people's minds, and that's Mayor Bloomberg.
Yeah.
You know, he's spending a lot of money. He's shooting up in the polls. Obviously, the people who are in the race now are beginning to attack him, which is a sure sign that he's doing well. What do you think?
I think that Bloomberg's candidacy, while it was maybe not expected, has surprised some people in large part because of the money, yes, because he's hired enormous numbers of staff members. He has huge ground operations in big states, or important states, rather. But also, just my own political analysis of this, it seems to me that Bloomberg may be appealing to independent voters who might have voted for Trump because they viewed him as a successful businessman and, you know, we need a corporate mentality to run the government, that he kind of fills that niche in some people's minds as well. You know, that he is obviously Mike Bloomberg is a successful businessman. He's a self-made man. You know, he's made these billions of dollars. And so for people for whom that is an appealing attribute, maybe he is peeling off some of those sorts of voters. And then you start to see a credible argument for a broader national candidacy, right? Because you don't just win the presidency anymore by getting your party. You have to get the mushy middle. You have to get that third of voters who don't align with either Democrats or Republicans. And I think the argument being made for Michael Bloomberg is that not necessarily that he is a Democrat. Of course, he was a Republican, but that he can appeal to moderates in the middle. And those are the people that are going to decide who's the next president.
We love having Jesse McKinley, and we're honored. The Albany bureau chief of the New York Times with us. And Jesse, keep coming back, I implore you. And thank you so much for being with us.
Absolutely, Alan. Thank you.